From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Well, for Vice President Cheney, I think it's a serious blow to his legacy, his vice presidency. It's always going to raise questions.
Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, has been sentenced to 30 months in prison. Investigative journalist Murray Wass on what would be the first jailing of a top administration official since Watergate. Plus, Iraqi oil workers have gone on strike against a U.S. proposed oil law. We'll speak with author Antonia Yuhas.
In the supplemental war spending bill that passed just over a week ago, it's the Democrats now that have required that the Iraqis pass this oil law as a condition of continued reconstruction fund. It's a critical moment for the Democrats if they're going to show that they're on the side of the American people or if they're just going to offer us a Bush light.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Dick Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, has been sentenced to 30 months in prison for lying to federal prosecutors about his role in the CIA leak case. A jury convicted Libby in March on four felony counts of making false statements to the FBI, lying to a grand jury, and obstructing a probe into the leak of Valerie Plame's identity. Administration officials outed Plame after her husband, former U.S. Ambassador Joe Wilson, publicly challenged the Bush administration's case for going to war in Iraq. Libby could still avoid serving his prison sentence if President Bush grants him a pardon. On Tuesday, White House officials said the president's not going to intervene for now. In Baghdad, Iraqi lawmakers have passed a resolution that may force an end to the U.S. military occupation. By an 85-59 vote, the Iraqi parliament passed a binding resolution to require the al-Maliki government consult lawmakers before extending the U.S. military mandate in Iraq. The move was spearheaded by supporters of the Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, as well as several Sunni parties. Iraqi blogger Ra'ed Jarar described the vote as an enormous development. Jarar reports lawmakers in Baghdad are planning to block the extension of the coalition's mandate when it comes up for renewal in 6 months. In other Iraq news, the Associated Press reports the U.S. air war in Iraq has greatly intensified in recent months. U.S. aircraft dropped more bombs and missiles in the first 4.5 months of 2007 than all of last year. At the same time, the number of civilian Iraqi casualties from U.S. airstrikes appears to have risen sharply. Meanwhile, the United Nations now estimates 4.2 million Iraqis have been forced to flee their homes because of the Iraq war and U.S. occupation. On Tuesday, the U.N. High Commissioner for Refugees pleaded for countries to do more to help the refugees. In New Hampshire, the Republican presidential candidates met for their third debate last night. Issues discussed included the war in Iraq, immigration, and the U.S.-Iranian relations. Former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani refused to rule out attacking Iran with nuclear weapons.
I think it could be done with conventional weapons, but you can't rule out anything, and you shouldn't take any option off the table. And during the debate the other night, the Democrats seemed to be back in the 1990s. They don't seem to have gotten beyond the Cold War. Iran is a threat, a nuclear threat, not just because they can deliver a nuclear warhead with missiles. They're a nuclear threat because they are the biggest state sponsor of terrorism, and they can hand nuclear materials to terrorists.
Former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney also refused to rule out a nuclear strike against Iran.
You don't take options off the table, but what you do is stand back and say, what's going on here? Do you see what's happening in Sudan and Afghanistan and Iraq and Iran? All over the world, we're seeing the same thing happening. And that is, people are testing the United States of America. And we have to make sure they understand that we're not arrogant. We have resolve. And we have the strength to protect our interests and to protect people who love liberty.
During the Republican debate, President Bush was repeatedly criticized. The audience applauded when Congressmember Tom Tancredo said Bush would never darken the doorstep of his White House. Meanwhile, Senator John McCain expressed his continued support for President Bush's escalation of the war in Iraq.
I won't think this strategy needs to be given a chance to succeed. We haven't barely gotten the 5th Brigade over there, which is part of this strategy. I am convinced that if we fail and we have to withdraw, they will follow us home. It will be a base for al-Qaeda, and we will be facing greater challenges and greater sacrifices.
In other campaign news, the presidents of two large labor unions have written to Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton to complain about her ties between chief strategist Mark Penn and union busting efforts. In a letter to Clinton, James Hoffa of the Teamsters and Bruce Rayner of Unite Here criticized the anti-union activities of the public relations firm Burson Marsteller, which is headed by Penn. In Germany, police arrested 57 protesters on Tuesday ahead of President Bush's arrival for the G8 summit. About 400 demonstrators with anti-G8 signs tried to block one of the road exits from Rostock Airport shortly before Bush landed. They held banners reading, "Bush is a murderer," and shouted, "Yankee, go home." Meanwhile, tensions remain high between President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin over the Bush administration's plan to station a missile defense system in the Czech Republic and Poland. On Tuesday, China joined Russia in denouncing the system. China warned it could result in a new arms race. President Bush visited the Czech Republic Tuesday and defended his plans.
My attitude on missile defense is that this is a purely, not my attitude, it's the truth, it's a purely defensive measure. Aim not at Russia, but at true threats. And therefore, as the president mentioned, I look forward to having conversations with President Putin, not only at the G8, but up in the United States when he comes over. And my message will be, you know, Vladimir, I call him Vladimir, that you shouldn't fear a missile defense system.
As the world leaders prepare to discuss solutions to global warming at the G8 meeting, more warnings are coming from the scientific community about climate change. A new United Nations report has determined Greenland's ice cap is already melting at alarming rates and that the temperatures in polar regions are expected to rise twice as fast as the global average in coming decades. This is Connie Steffen of the University of Colorado Boulder.
Warmer temperature in spring, warmer temperature in fall made the melt period in Greenland much longer. And therefore, we see more and more meltwater flowing off from the ice sheet into the ocean and decreasing the reflection of the sun, which has a feedback. We call that a positive feedback mechanism. And we have seen that over the last 15 years, there is a steady increase of melt from the ice sheet.
Dr. Connie Steffen said the melting ice caps could have dire effects on sea levels.
If you take, for example, this glacier, Jakobshof and Isbrae, and you take the volume of these icebergs that are breaking off every 2 to 3 days, they're breaking off constantly, but let's take the volume of 2 to 3 days iceberg. This is enough fresh water for the entire city of New York for 1 year.
Two more Palestinians have died in a pair of Israeli attacks in the West Bank and Gaza. In the West Bank town of Hebron, Israeli troops killed an 80-year-old man in a house raid. In Gaza, an Israeli airstrike killed one man. The killings occurred as Palestinians and Israelis marked the 40th anniversary of the 1967 Six-Day War, when Israel seized the West Bank and Gaza. This is Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas.
Even in June, the Six-Day War went down in history as marking the defeat of the Arabs by Israel. Our standing up to this defeat, in spite of the hardships, could make up for what we have lost in war. Perhaps we can even erase it from memory with a great achievement, putting an end to the occupation of Palestinian and Arab lands, creating our independent state, recovering our Jerusalem, solving the refugee problem in a just and acceptable manner based on legitimate international resolutions.
Meanwhile, in Jerusalem, Israeli peace activists gathered to protest the existence of Jewish settlements in the occupied West Bank.
We are here to say the situation has to be stopped. Between occupation has to be stopped. There is an option of solution, of two-state solution, withdraw from territories, two capitals in Jerusalem, and we think that we have to do everything to stop the terrible situation.
On Capitol Hill, Senator Patrick Leahy, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, has called on the White House to work with the Democratic-controlled Congress in order to craft a new legal framework for the military tribunals at Guantanamo. Leahy's call came one day after military judges dismissed war crimes charges against two prisoners. Leahy said, quote, the place to start is by restoring the hallmark of justice known as the Great Writ of Habeas Corpus. Meanwhile, in Canada, the family of Omar Khadr said they are overjoyed at learning charges were dropped against him. Omar Khadr has been held by the U.S. since he was 15 years old. He was first detained in Afghanistan. This is his sister, Zineb Khadr.
I think they're going to find another way to re-charge him. But at least they found a loop, in, a hole in the loop, and they're trying something else. I mean, it just says that we're moving on. Maybe not the way we'd like it to move, or maybe not as fast as we'd like it to move, but it's moving.
Reporters asked Omar Khadr's sister about how her brother's doing.
His letters seem to portray him as he's doing okay, just a lot more mature than he used to be. I mean, he was 15. He's telling us to be strong and telling us to hang in there and telling us to have faith. And, but physically, according to the lawyer and a lot of people who are seeing him, is that, well, it's having its toll on him. But who wouldn't it have its toll on? He was almost dead when they took him, and it's had a heavy toll and completely, perfectly healthy men with a child. So.
Back in this country, a new study on the effects of media consolidation has revealed women and minorities own a shrinking percentage of the nation's commercial radio stations. According to the group Free Press, women own just 6% of all full-power commercial stations nationwide, and racial or ethnic minorities own less than 8%. The study also found these stations are more likely to broadcast local content and diverse programming than ones owned by white men. And in Jackson, Mississippi, a former member of the Ku Klux Klan is on trial for murdering two black teenagers in 1964. James Ford Seo was first arrested shortly after the killings, but the charges were thrown out after the FBI turned the case over to local authorities. The Justice Department reopened the case 2 years ago. On Tuesday, a cousin of Seal named Charles Marcus Edwards testified he and Seal had abducted and attacked the black teens. Edwards said Seal and other Klansmen then drove the teenagers across the Louisiana border. They put duct tape over their mouths and then dumped them in the Mississippi River alive. The victims, Henry Hezekiah D. and Charles Eddie Moore, were both 19 years old. Their bodies were found 2 months later, when authorities were conducting an intensive search for the slain civil rights workers Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman, who disappeared from central Mississippi's Neshoba County on June 21st, 1964. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby, has been sentenced to 30 months in prison for lying to federal prosecutors about his role in the CIA leak case. A jury convicted Libby in March on four felony counts of making false statements to the FBI, lying to a grand jury, and obstructing a probe into the leak of Valerie Plame's identity. Administration officials outed Plame after her husband, former U.S. Ambassador Joe Wilson, publicly challenged the Bush administration's case for going to war with Iraq. Libby is the highest-ranking White House official to be convicted of a felony since the Iran-Contra scandal nearly two decades ago. On Tuesday, U.S. District Judge Reggie Walton handed down the sentence and a $250,000 fine. An appeal hearing has been set for next week, but Judge Walton says he's unlikely to reverse his decision. Libby could wind up in jail by the end of next month. The ruling immediately put the spotlight on President Bush. The president has not ruled out granting Libby a pardon. At their debate in New Hampshire, four Republican presidential candidates said they would not pardon Libby. The leading candidates, Arizona Senator John McCain, former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, and former New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani, said they would consider a pardon if elected. Meanwhile, in a statement, Joe and Valerie Wilson said they are grateful, quote, justice has been served. They go on to say, quote, that Libby would knowingly lie, perjure himself, and obstruct a legitimate criminal investigation is incomprehensible. It is our hope that he will now cooperate with Special Counsel Fitzgerald in his efforts to get to the truth. As Mr. Fitzgerald has said, a cloud remains over the vice president. Every official in this administration must be held accountable for their actions, they wrote. Murray Wass is a veteran investigative reporter. He's with the National Journal. He's covered the Libby case extensively. He's just come out with a new book, The United States versus I, Louis Libby. Late yesterday, I spoke to Murray Wass in Washington, D.C. to get his reaction to the Libby sentencing.
Well, I think the judge today sent out what he thought was a strong message with a tough sentence. It was a little extraordinary that he sentenced Scooter Libby to a term of incarceration much, much longer than the probation office recommended, and sided with the prosecutor. So we've now heard the jury render a verdict, and now we've heard the judge met out his sentencing, and with it a message, I believe.
What do you think that message is?
Well, Judge Walton, the judge, is kind of an interesting guy because he's a conservative Republican, or he was before he was on the bench. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan. He had been a drug czar official in the Reagan administration. And you could kind of sense during the trial, but you found out today because of the long sentence he gave Libby that, and from his comments and from his response to the special prosecutor's comments, Pat Fitzgerald, that government officials can't lie with impunity to a grand jury. They can't lie to the FBI, and they can't obstruct justice. There were four convictions for obstruction of justice, perjury, and lying to investigators. And the arguments seemed in part to be that because of his government service, he shouldn't serve any time. And Judge Walton disagreed with that, said no to that, and did practically just the opposite. In effect, I think the news today was that he tried to send not only the defendant a message, but he wanted to send the people in government or other people who are thinking of doing what Scooter Libby did, a message, don't do that.
Why don't you go through for us again, Murray, why you think what Scooter Libby did was so egregious. Go through, start from the beginning.
I don't want to say I think it's egregious, but I'll tell you, he was convicted by a jury, and he was sentenced today by the judge, pending appeal, of course. But what he was accused of doing was lying to the FBI, lying to, committing perjury before a grand jury, and obstructing justice to cover up his role, and also the role of perhaps others, including Vice President Cheney, in leaking the name and leaking information about the covert CIA officer, Valerie Plame. And essentially, the trial showed, and what the jury found, is that he engaged in those actions to cover up his role and other people in the Bush administration in leaking Plame's name, and so that's that I guess is at the core of what the case was about.
You write in the introduction to the court transcript in the book, The United versus I. Lewis Libby, The United States versus I. Lewis Libby, the last compartment. Talk about late in the morning of July 12, 2003, Vice President Cheney and Scooter Libby together in Virginia, and exactly what transpired as you understand it.
Well, on July 12th, the Vice President, Scooter Libby, they were involved in this damage control effort to discredit Joe Wilson, Valerie Plame's husband. Joe Wilson was an ambassador who had made claims that the Bush administration misrepresented intelligence to go to war. And Joe Wilson went to the African country of Niger to investigate allegations that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy uranium to build an atomic weapon. And Wilson came back and found that wasn't the case, but that intelligence information still ended up being cited again and again, and including in the President's State of the Union speech, to make the case to go to war. So on July 12th, they're involved in an effort to discredit Wilson, to blunt his allegations. They're working actively in a damage control mood. They're pressuring the director, the then director of the CIA, George Tenet, to take blame, to kind of fall on the sword, in effect. And Scooter Libby and Vice President Cheney and their families go to the Norfolk Naval Base to christen the USS Reagan. And on the way home, they discuss at length how to control the scandal. And so the vice president and Scooter Libby sit alone, and it's kind of, so it's figured, they sit alone in a compartment in the plane, and it's kind of literally a compartment of the plane, but it's also figuratively a compartment of the plane where only Scooter Libby and only Dick Cheney will know till the end of time what transpired between them. But essentially what happens is the vice president dictates to Scooter Libby talking points, things he wants Libby to say to reporters to discredit Wilson and to make the administration look good. The only thing that Scooter Libby doesn't admit, Scooter Libby, when he gets off the plane, then calls reporters, Matthew Cooper of Time Magazine and Judy Miller, and tells them about Plame's covert CIA status. So everything else that Scooter Libby told Matt Cooper, everything he told Judy Miller, those things were things that Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby agreed that Dick Cheney told them to say. But on
and
the issue of Valerie's
claim,
talking
points, Murray, you know about those talking points that Cheney dictated because?
Because they're in effect a public record now, because during the trial they were entered into evidence. And so the vice president was actively, before July 12th, he was instructing Scooter Libby to talk to specific reporters, to provide them with specific information. Vice President Cheney was involved, was in charge of the effort, in effect, and Scooter Libby, as his aide, was carrying out, to a large degree, what the vice president wanted done. The only thing that went beyond, purportedly, the vice president would say what he wanted done was the naming of Valerie Plame, but everything else he wanted done. So I guess at the end of the day, what's interesting is after being directed to talk to specific reporters, after being directed to tell them specific things, Scooter Libby also tells them about Valerie Plame, but according to Scooter Libby, everybody's lying, and he didn't tell them about Valerie Plame in the way that he did. And according to Libby and the vice president, they didn't collude to do that. So it's just that one little fact, which all of a sudden Scooter Libby, who's the loyal staff man, who's taking orders from the vice president, who's doing exactly what he says, veers off and acts like a freelancer and a loose cannon.
Murray Wass, investigative reporter, author of the new book, The United States Versus I, Louis Libby. We'll be back with him in a minute. Music by UB40 here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The War and Peace Report is a return to our interview with investigative reporter Murray Wass on the sentencing of Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, Louis Scooter Libby. I asked Murray what Libby's jail sentence could mean for Vice President Dick Cheney and also, well, President Bush's top deputy, Karl Rove.
Well, for Vice President Cheney, I think it's a serious blow to his legacy, his vice presidency. It's always going to raise questions. Dick Cheney wasn't in the dock. Dick Cheney wasn't charged. But the trial transcript and the exhibits, the comments by the prosecutor, the strong statement implicitly made in the sentencing by the judge all, I think, are going to point to an historical record or perhaps an historical judgment that is not going to, you know, bear well for the vice president.
And Karl Rove?
Karl Rove wasn't charged in this case. He was under suspicion. Some of the grand jurors were surprised when Pat Fitzgerald didn't ask for an indictment in the case. But at the end of the day, I think from a legal vantage point, the fact that he didn't get charged, he should be given the benefit of the doubt. He didn't do anything wrong, you know, criminally. Like the inference, just because he appeared before a grand jury doesn't mean that people should think he did something criminal. The judgment, there is other judgments that people can or can't make if they want to about his role in outing Valerie Plame and giving her name out. And again, those go beyond the legal system and will be kind of more judgments for history or judgments that, you know, people are entitled to have now, obviously.
Richard Armitage, Colin Powell's deputy at the State Department, was the first to leak Valerie Plame's CIA identity, and he did it to Bob Woodward. Why wasn't he indicted?
Well, I don't think there was intent, and there's a difference. Scooter Libby was charged with perjury, obstruction, and lying to investigators about what he did. Richard Armitage owned up to what he did. As soon as he realized what happened, he went to the prosecutor. There was testimony he didn't even have a lawyer. He just went in, sat down, told him what happened. Apparently, he gossiped the information away. He didn't have any intent, or there's no evidence of intent to smear Joe Wilson, to damage Valerie Plame. A lot of Scooter Libby's defenders have said, look at Armitage. He's the guy who started it all. Scooter Libby was in at the end. But the effort to out Valerie Plame, the effort to name her, the discussions in the White House went on earlier than Dick Armitage gave the name to Bob Woodward. So it's kind of a red herring. A lot of people have suggested that because Armitage did it, what Libby did wasn't so wrong. But the effort was already underway, organized to give out the name. And Dick Armitage was just another kind of person involved, but not working in concert with Scooter Libby or Karl Rove.
George Tenet, the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
He was not involved in any way in outing Valerie Plame.
And what the bigger picture was, the context of all of this, and what this meant for the war in Iraq?
Well, I think the broader context is what happened when this was going on. The war had seemed to be going well to that point, but we were having the first indications of an insurgency. We were also having the first indications that there was difficulty in finding any weapons of mass destruction. You know, the major pretext for war had been there was biological, chemical weapons that Saddam Hussein was developing, that he was attempting to build a nuclear weapon. And so as the inspectors weren't finding anything and people in the White House were a little surprised or upset or feeling defensive about that, Joe Wilson was kind of really the first person to go out and make a public claim that the Bush administration had lied about the intelligence to make the case to go to war. And so combined with the pressure of actually not finding the weapons of mass destruction, there was this intense sensitivity at the White House and intense anger, obviously, too, at Wilson. And they wanted to, you know, blunt his criticism and discredit him. And so that's the context that this occurred, that the Valerie Plame thing occurred in, the broader context. Hope.
Again, we're talking to investigative reporter Murray Wass. So you have Scooter Libby sentenced to 2.5 years in jail. What about the big question? What could happen? The possibility of a pardon? What do you see?
Well, the key issue is going to be whether he's remanded to custody in the next couple weeks. Judge Walton has asked the probation officer to do a report. If Judge Walton allows Scooter Libby to remain free upon pending an appeal, that means that he wouldn't serve any prison time until about the time President Bush is done with his presidency. So it would be much easier. President Bush, President Ford, presidents have traditionally done pardons. Well, I'm sorry, I'm mistaken about President Ford, but President Bush did last-minute pardons for Iran-Contra figures. So the idea, I think the conventional wisdom is that President Bush would pardon Scooter Libby in the final weeks of his presidency after the 2008 election was through. But if he was remanded to custody soon or immediately, either that would, and the president wanted to pardon him, he would have to pardon him now, and the political implications would be immediate. So it'd be much more, it would be interesting because it would be much more difficult politically and public opinion-wise for the president to pardon Scooter Libby now versus like in the final days of his administration. And so we won't know for a little bit whether Scooter Libby will be sent to prison now or be free for most of the rest of the last year and some months of the president's administration. And Judge Walton indicated today from comments that he made that he's predisposed to actually incarcerate Scooter Libby, you know, sooner rather than later. But that's it's still a judgment and still a decision that he hasn't completely made. So we don't know how that's going to end up.
Murray, you wrote a piece recently on a wholly different issue. It was a piece in the Huffington Post called "The Ninth Man Out, A Fired U.S. Attorney Tells His Story." Can you tell us about the significance of this, and this, of course, in the context of Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general?
Yeah, the piece was about Todd Graves, who now is the ninth U.S. attorney we've learned that the Bush administration ordered to resign or fired. Todd Graves was actually the first of all of the U.S. attorneys to be fired, but he's kind of referred to as the ninth man out because Todd Graves was very shy and reluctant about talking about having been fired. So we've learned about him as the last example. There might be more than nine, but right now he's the last one we've learned about, but the actual first one that was fired. And he actually today, as we're speaking, he's testifying before Congress. And the guy who replaced him, who was a senior official in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice, who disagreed with Todd Graves and was pushing him to make voter fraud cases, he's testifying as well today. So.
Well, tell us his story. Tell us about this U.S. attorney, the story you tell about cancer, about chemotherapy, about corporate fraud.
Well, he was a real compelling figure to me. He prosecuted one of the worst medical fraud cases in this country's history in the sense of the heinous nature of the crime. He prosecuted a pharmacist named Robert Courtney who diluted and watered down 4,000 chemotherapy prescriptions for more than 4,000 cancer patients. And the pharmacists also watered down, as best they could determine, 98 different prescriptions for all kinds of people with different types of cancer. Undoubtedly, numbers of people lost their lives. Lives were cut short. The devastation that this one person caused is just on the community of around Kansas City and a community where his pharmacy was is almost unspeakable. So Todd Graves was the U.S. attorney in charge of that case. And what was so compelling about having an interview with him is what was kind of unknown to the public, or what was, if it was known to the public, it wasn't played up, was the fact that when Todd Graves prosecuted that case in his own past, when he was 21 years old and in college, he was diagnosed with a rare form of lymphoma, not giving very much of a chance to live at all, was told at the age of 21 to wrap up his affairs and put his affairs in order. And somehow he survived and has had a great life since. And he might have survived, or it's likely he survived, because he had some really toxic, awful, painful, difficult chemotherapy that he described to me as just, you know, he would be in pain. He would have this for 26 hours straight. He couldn't sleep or eat. He would just be in pain. And so he knew. So what was interesting and compelling is this U.S. attorney knew firsthand that chemotherapy is very important to cancer patients because when he was 21 years old, he was a cancer patient on chemo. And so he never has really talked about this at length with a reporter before. And I was able to get him to open up and kind of tell this extraordinary story. And one of the reasons he didn't want to talk about it previously was because he thought the focus would be on him instead of the criminal and the crime victims, and people might think he was overzealous and so forth.
The pharmacist, Robert Courtney, worth close to $19 million, owning two mansions in Kansas City, just outside of it, and a condominium in St. Croix. When he was sentenced, and what happened to the money?
The money went to—well, he had a fight with the people in the Department of Justice. He wanted to give the money to the victims. They wanted to return the money to the United States Treasury. Again, he was kind of afraid that he would be seen because of his personal experience of being overzealous, but he stuck to his guns. He fought the bureaucracy, and ultimately he accomplished what he wanted to do, which was use the—I think it was $17 or $18 million that they actually found and confiscated— and was able to return that to the victims instead of just giving it to some general fund of the Treasury. But again, as you point out, the amount of money, that huge amount of money, $18, $19 million, was the profit of watering down chemotherapy and watering down other—he also watered down other types of drugs, like insulin for diabetics, or all these people who thought they were getting their prescriptions from their druggist were getting sugar water. In a lot of instances.
Murray Wass, a final subject that you've taken on, where in the heat of the presidential race, yes, even a year and a half before the race will take place, the actual election will take place, and you've looked at one of the Republican candidates, the Arkansas Governor Huckabee.
Governor Huckabee.
Can you talk about Governor Huckabee?
Yeah, I'd done a piece a few years back about Governor Huckabee. He had lobbied his parole board, or pressured his parole board, to release a convicted rapist. And originally he had decided he was going to pardon this guy, but the public outcry was so great that he had to kind of back off. So he still wanted him—he still thought the guy was deserving of leaving jail. And so to kind of take his—to make sure his fingerprints weren't on the act— or to not take the heat for the pardon, he went and he lobbied one-on-one or in groups their parole board members
to instead
free this guy, Wayne Dumont, who then shortly thereafter, after he's let out of prison, just in the most violent rape and the most violent murders, just raped and murdered two young women. I believe one was 19 and one was 23. And Governor Huckabee refuses to talk about his reasons for the pardon. He refuses to answer specific questions. Tim Russert asked them on Meet the Press, asked them a couple questions about it, read a couple questions from my story. But the format of Meet the Press is such that it moves on so quickly, you wasn't really able to press them for answers. So Governor Huckabee is running for the presidency and still refuses to answer any questions about why he made this decision or how he came to it.
Calling you a tabloid reporter.
I think he made that comment. But you won't agree with that, would you?
Why did he care about Wayne DeMond?
We're not entirely sure. One thing that's pretty interesting is that the right-wing press and a lot of the right-wing media were writing stories that the rapist, this guy Wayne DeMond, was in jail unfairly or had been framed because the rape victim was a relative of Bill Clinton's, which are a distant cousin, which actually turned out pretty much not to be true. The relationship is so distant, they maybe met each other once or twice, but it made good copy. So it made good copy to bash Bill Clinton and blame him for something else. And so there was one columnist in particular for the New York Post who Governor Huckabee liked to read, named Steve Dunleavy. And Steve Dunleavy wrote a series of columns saying that this guy, Wayne DeMond, the rapist, was a war hero, when in fact he wasn't a war hero, but he was kicked out of the military with a dishonorable discharge. This guy, Steve Dunleavy, said that the rapist was cleared by DNA evidence, which is a complete falsehood. They didn't have DNA evidence at the time. There was no DNA evidence in the case or later. So apparently, some of this might have been caused by just erroneous, irresponsible press coverage, where journalists might, you can blame the governor. The governor should have relied on the court records and done his homework instead of reading the New York Post.
Final question, Murray, and this goes back to the top story, and that is Scooter Libby getting sentence of 2.5 years, a $250,000 fine. What now happens to Valerie Plame? What happens to her lawsuit that she has against?
I think the civil suit can proceed when the criminal stuff is over. So I think what it does, I think the thing that happens today, or perhaps it starts pending the appeal, is that they can then proceed with that civil suit. And it's very rare to bring a civil suit against the vice president. The only kind of similar thing I can think of is the Paul Jones case against President Clinton. So we're into uncharted territory. But it seems like it's a much more substantial case, or much more serious case than the Paul Jones case. So we've seen the Paul Jones case proceed. So we assume this will go ahead too, and it should be the civil case should be a vast source of information, discovery of new information, and perhaps the historical record will get straight as more information about what happened comes out.
Could it lead to a parallel criminal investigation of Vice President Cheney?
Well, I think that Fitzgerald is pretty much, his hands are tied beyond what happened today, absent Scooter Libby making a deal and testifying against any other official of the administration. But what's interesting is what Ken Starr did was look at erroneous, well, supposedly false statements or perjury, alleged perjury by President Clinton in the Paul Jones case. So by having a vast civil record, by having days and days of sworn testimony and officials on the record, including perhaps the vice president, it does open the possibility that those statements could be scrutinized by Pat Fitzgerald in the future, or whoever else would have, jurisdiction in case he wasn't still in government at that point.
And President Bush, is he touched by any of this?
President Bush there's no information that he was involved in directing anyone or knew about the outing of Valerie Plame. One thing he did, though, which I wrote about, is he more broadly put Vice President Cheney in charge of the effort after Cheney complained that the White House was doing an inadequate job, he put him in charge of the effort to do the damage control about the Wilson column and the WMD issue in general. But it'd be unfair to say that because President Bush directed Cheney to lead that broader effort that he knew anything much about Valerie Plame.
Investigative reporter Murray Wass has edited the new book, The United States versus I, Lewis Libby. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, Antonia Yuhas on the Bush agenda and the Democrats invading the world one economy at a time. Stay with us. Music by Amir Taufik from About Baghdad, the film. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we turn to Iraq. As the Iraqi parliament moves closer to a final vote on a controversial oil law, local opposition is growing. This week, oil workers in southern Iraq announced a strike to oppose the law and demand better wages. More than 600 workers are taking part, affecting two major pipelines. The workers want to be a part of the negotiation process from which they've been excluded. Critics say the law will expose Iraq's oil to major privatization and foreign takeover. My next guest has written extensively about the economic side of the U.S. occupation of Iraq. Antonia Yuhas is Tarbell Fellow at the Oil Change International. She's the author of the book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World One Economy at a Time, which has just come out in paperback. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me.
First, talk about this strike, Antonia.
Well, the strike is critical. It's been a long time building. There had been some negotiations between the strike leaders and Prime Minister al-Maliki. There are a number of demands, basic working conditions, wages, as you say, but also a seat at the table and opposition to the attempt to turn over Iraq's oil to foreign oil corporations. And the as more knowledge has been brought to Iraq, it's been very difficult for Iraqis to even learn what this oil law was about, just like it's been difficult here. As more information has spread, the opposition has spread as well. And now the workers have taken situation into their own hands and struck.
And what is this U.S.-backed proposal?
It's a Bush administration, U.S. corporate, very simple attempt to figure out if you're going to wage a war for oil, how do you get the oil? You know, does Exxon come in on a tank with a flag and stick it in the ground? Or do you have a more careful process? The careful process is very simply write a law, get a new Iraqi government in place, have the Iraqis pass the law, and then turn the oil over to U.S. oil corporations. The Bush administration designed the law. Last January, President Bush announced that it was a benchmark for passage by the Iraqi government. It was the same day that he announced the surge. And in the language of the administration, the surge was meant to provide the political space so that the Iraqis could discuss the oil law and other benchmarks. The Democrats then adopted this language of the benchmarks and said in the supplemental war spending bill, again, that the Iraqis have to pass this benchmark. And it very simply turns Iraq from a nationalized oil system, essentially closed to U.S. oil corporations, to a privatized system in which potentially two-thirds of all of Iraq's oil could be owned by foreign oil companies, and they can control the production with as long as 30-year contracts.
Now, what about the new the news coming out of Iraq that Raad Gerar has reported on, talking about the significance of the vote for the U.S. to get out of Iraq by the parliament?
It's very significant. The United Nations mandate for the U.S. occupation of Iraq gives ultimate authority to the Iraqi parliament and the Iraqi cabinet to determine if the occupation can continue. So theoretically, if the Iraqi parliament joined by the cabinet, and that's critical, say that the occupation cannot continue, theoretically it would have to end. That stands in vast opposition to the plans of the Bush administration and now apparently the plans of the Democratic leadership as well.
Couldn't it give Bush an out?
It could give Bush an out if he wanted an out. I don't think he wants an out.
Because?
I think there's many ways in which the war is not going all bad for the president and for the administration. The only thing that's truly going bad is the instability. But what has worked is a government in place that is more amenable to U.S. interests than the last 10 years of the Hussein regime, a government in place that is willing to negotiate in a dramatic fashion on the nature of Iraq's oil regime, and being on the precipice of a transfer of Iraq, a fundamental transfer in its oil policy. We have U.S. oil corporations engaging daily in negotiations with the Iraqi oil ministry, waiting on the sidelines. If the law passes, U.S. corporations have the potential to own a true bonanza of oil. And if the U.S. military stays, protection to get in and get it. Now,
which companies in particular?
Chevron, Exxon, Conoco, BP, Shell, Marathon.
Are all now working intensively with the oil ministry?
Yeah, they absolutely are and have been from the beginning.
And if they don't pass this law?
If they don't pass the law, it's a big strike at the heart of the agenda. I would say that the game wouldn't be over. And the fact that the administration is talking publicly about this Korea policy, the idea that the United States would maintain some sort of military presence similar to the U.S. presence, quote-unquote, keeping the peace between South and North Korea, that's a permanent military engagement, which could last as long as 50 years. The 30-year contracts, the extended length of the occupation leads me to believe that this is the idea that the administration wants to pursue.
And what do you think of this comparison?
It's incredibly disturbing. First of all, the conditions are completely dissimilar, except for the desire of the United States to maintain a presence and to use the misunderstanding, I think, of the American public as to the role of the U.S. military in Korea to say, well, we've created peace for 50 years in one situation. We can create peace for 50 years in this other situation. Oh, and by the way, our military will be really well situated to move forward across the region to spread peace across the Middle East, where, oh, by the way, there also happens to be 2/3 of the world's remaining oil. It's a terrifying proposition.
Antonia Yuhas, right now, looking at Iraq, we talk about President Bush. What about the Democrats? We have a Democrat-controlled House and Senate.
Yeah, and the afterword to the Bush agenda, which I just finished writing in February, I was extremely excited at the move of the Democrats to take over the House and the Senate. And I was particularly excited in terms of the mandate that the American public had given them on the war, ending the war. That mandate brought a lot of excitement as well from the American public, which as I tour around the country, as I tour around the world, I have seen that energy slowly, slowly, slowly dissipate as people watched the Democrats play politics with the lives of U.S. soldiers, with the lives of Iraqis, with the hope of the American public. That energy has just dissipated, and the Democrats have proven that it's all about politics in the end, that it's all about their, I think, misinterpretation of what's going to get them the 2008 presidential election. I think they're wrong on their calculation.
What's the calculation?
The American public is afraid of just a quick end to the war, that they need to seem more reasonable, and I think that that's why the Democrats picked up and the Democratic leadership picked up the benchmark language. We'll make the Iraqis do some work If they don't do the work, then maybe we'll end the occupation. Although that language changed in the final supplemental, and instead of saying if the Iraqis don't pass the benchmarks, then we'll end the occupation, the language changed to if the Iraqis don't pass the benchmarks, we'll cut off reconstruction funds, which is obscene in itself. But that the American public doesn't want them to end the war right away, and that they need to seem more reasonable, and they need to wait out the war and blame it on the Republicans. And that's how they're going to win the 2008 presidential election. I think what that calculation is going to do is going to cause them, maybe not at the end of the day, if we're sitting in a booth and the choice is between Hillary Clinton and Newt Gingrich, that most Democrats or most of the public won't choose Hillary Clinton, but rather that all of that energy, that legwork, that activism, that spirit that got them the House and the Senate is going to be gone.
Where does trade fit into the story of war?
The Democratic leadership is also playing fast and quick with an agenda that also got the Democrats into the House and the Senate, which was a mandate to not focus on the advancement of rights of the largest multinational corporations in the world by expanding a free hand for them through a free trade agenda, but rather to focus on fair trade, the interests of small business, local communities, local development. The Democratic leadership has been doing private deal making with the administration, making deals to pass trade agreements with Peru, with Colombia, with Panama, and potentially allowing the administration a hand to move forward with fast track, a negotiating mechanism which puts all of the power into the administration and takes it all away from the Congress.
We are talking as the G8 is meeting, and the mass protests are taking place outside. In fact, at the end of the afterword to the paperback of the Bush agenda, you talk about what is the hope.
The situation with the G8 has been both very exciting and very disturbing, of course, because the violence has been so extreme against the people organizing to protest. But the fact that that energy is still there, that resistance is still there, and also the dialogue has changed fundamentally in the meeting in the G8. It's now focused on how to get the United States in line with climate chaos, addressing climate chaos, how to thwart U.S. attempts to build the missile defense plan. And the power of the administration is clearly, clearly waning. I mean, there's not much left of the original administration at this point between Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and Libby, and they're all getting knocked off. They're losing their positions one by one. And that is the success of the resistance of our movements. Our movements have had a tremendous fundamental shift, forced a fundamental shift in the debate, in the well of support, which has completely dried up for this administration. And we have successfully linked with global struggles, with global people around the world, to demonstrate that while our government may be following this imperial agenda, the people of the United States do not share that agenda and are working with people around the world to stop it. And the G8 meeting is a wonderful example of that taking place right now.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Antonia Yuhas, for joining us. Antonia Yuhas is an author and activist. Her books have appeared in the New York Times. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times, the Cambridge University Review of International Relations Journal, the Los Angeles Times. The paperback of her book has just come out, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. She'll be speaking tonight in New York at 7 o'clock at All Souls Church up on Lexington. And on tomorrow night, on Thursday, I'll be with John Pilger at the New School on West 12th. He'll be our special guest tomorrow on Democracy Now!, the world-renowned filmmaker. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Aaron Matej, Jen Utes, Anjali Kamat. Happy birthday to Danielle Stramberg-Peshkin. Mike DeFilippo, Nick Marsilio, Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks also to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Jose Miranda, Jillian O'Connor, Tori Townsend, Nicole Salazar, Samantha Chamblay. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.